Okay, let's do it. Let's start by grading the quiz. Quiz number three. So, again, apologize for the typo. The five in front of the laleo. But I guess we'll start with that one. Anyone know what laleo means? Well done. I speak. Yep. Good. So I guess let's start at the top. Hara'o. Good. I see. Perceive. Akuo. Good. Excellent. That's how I remember, right? The English word acoustics comes from that. So it's I hear.
Is that the more sense, or is it to actually listen?
To understand, or is it Oh, no, there's another word, because it can be mean, it can also mean I understand, but
just the hearing.
Correct, so it's kind of like hearing and perceiving, but there's another word that is, it's not gnosko, it's oida. Oida is normally the word that is like I perceive, I, yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
So is oida on here?
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. So that's what, fifth from the bottom is oida.
Just above.
Yep. So oida would be more of your, I perceive. Yeah, I understand. Mm-hmm. Okay, so number three, the third one down. Palus, pale, palu.
Many.
Good. Excellent. Many. Much, many. If it's with a singular, then every. You could translate every. Didomi.
I give.
Good, I give. So we'll talk about this probably not tonight, because, you know, in a week or two, we'll talk about me verbs. Me verbs, it ends with a me, you know, the mi, the mu, a yoda. And me verbs have weird, they do weird things. And so, like, when we learn the basic forms of verbs and how they operate, and then me verbs are like an exception to most of the rules. But didomi is one of the most common verbs in the New Testament. So, and there's a few more me verbs that are very common, like aphimi, which is I forgive. That one's pretty common. So there's half a dozen me verbs that you will see a lot, but they don't. So you get used to them, but they don't follow. You know, they violate a lot of the normal verbal things. But the next one, pater or patras.
Father.
Good. Father. Nailed that one. Well done. Hemera.
Day.
Day. Yep. Good. Hemera is day. Pneuma or pneuma.
Spirit.
Well done. Yeah. See, you did that one. Well done. Huios.
Son.
Well done. Good. Good. The huias, well, oh wait, it's huian managane, magananan. It was an accusative, right? Maganes, it's managanes. As we were translating that last week, John 3. Okay, ace, no, I'm sorry, it's there's a ref breather. It's hais, mia, hen.
One.
Good, so those are all different forms of the word one. So it can appear in any one of those forms, but it's the number one. Adelphos. Good. You know this one. Yep. The city of. Yeah, there we go. That's how I remember. Philadelphia. City of brotherly love. So it's, you actually have phileo, right, for love, and then Adelphos, brother. Brotherly love. Next word, A. A. Good. Excellent. Or the conjunction. We talked about conjunctions last week. Eon. If, good, if, when, so remember that, just by repetition, I'm going to keep reminding you, the e'on, when you see e'on, you, most of the time, you're going to see a subjunctive verb following it, often, so it's one of those giveaways of a subjunctive. Peri. Well done. Good. We studied those last week. We'll actually probably start today with a review of prepositions. But that's a preposition to be, you know, around, perimeter. Logos.
Word.
Yeah, you guys know that one. He'autu. Good. So the reflexive pronoun. You remember the parts of speech pronoun, that's the reflexive pronoun. Oida, kind of already talked about that one. I know or perceive or understand. Leleo, I speak. Uranos.
Heaven.
Good. Heaven. Well done. Yep.
I thought it was Uranus or like a planet, but then I'm like, oh, it's actually heaven.
Yeah, well done. Yes, well done. Uranos. Yep. Good. The word for heaven. And then mathetes. Good. Yep. Disciple or follower. And then lambano.
This one's funny.
What's that?
This one's really funny.
How do you remember it?
Lambo,
as in like Lambo Field?
Lamb.
Oh.
Bone.
Oh, lamb bone.
The bone of a lamb.
The bone of a lamb.
I receive.
There you go.
Anyway, yeah.
Nice.
You got lucky, you got the lamb bones in my house.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Well, see, because I, you know, a lot of my vocab I memorized, you know, in college when I was up in Wisconsin. So Lambo Field, you know, is the whole take or receive. You know, that's the football stadium that Green Bay Packers play in. So that's how I remembered it. But
yeah.
I like it. I like it. Okay, so grade yourself. You know, it's just kind of, again, accountability, just kind of keep you rolling on the vocab. Because that really is one of the most important parts of learning Greek, is just memorizing vocab so that you can then recognize it, work with it as you read and translate. Okay, any thoughts, questions, comments on the vocab before we jump into our review? Okay, so let's jump back into prepositions real quick. Just by way of refresher, there was a couple things. There's only one or two extra things that I wanted to say about prepositions that we did not talk about last week. So we'll pick up where we left off. Again, a preposition is a word governing and usually preceding a noun or pronoun, and it expresses a relation to another word or element in the clause. So these are words like in, with, by, after, above, upon, beside, under, without, before, behind, all of these words. And many or most prepositions have to do with time, space, or direction. Prepositions can be somewhat elastic and have multiple meanings depending on context, case, because recall there's a number of them that mean something different depending on the case they're in, like meta is, you know, you see it in the top left of the chart there. Meta is with or after. With if it's with a genitive, after if it's with the accusative. So you memorize kind of a range of possible meanings, like in, the one right in the center, is normally, just in my mind, I always say in, with, or by. In, with, or by, because it can be locational, in or inside, or alongside, with, or among, like, you know, Jesus says, you know, I'm among you as one who serves, or it can be by, it can be instrumental. So you, like, that's one of the debates when it comes to, like, the baptism of the Holy Spirit. It says you are baptized with, it's in, the Holy Spirit. So it's, is it in, with, or by the Holy Spirit? And there's some debates on that, on which one makes the most sense. And, you know, not that we'll settle the debate, but the prepositions can be a little bit elastic. And so some, again, carry both a spatial and a temporal meaning, referring to time or space. Again, I already gave you those couple examples, in or meta. But prepositions often head a prepositional phrase, which is a modifying phrase consisting of a preposition and its object. So we are in the building. We are at the table. You are in front of or before the TV, right? I mean, it's like they're, so we typically will use a preposition and then its modifying phrase, which is typically a noun. And that's, that together is called a prepositional phrase. So again, your most frequent prepositions, I think we talked about this last time, and I did not type those with, it needs, they need accent marks, but in or into, in and ace are your two most frequent, then ek, epi, pros, dia, apa, kata, and I'm just listing them in the order of their usage, the most common ones, meta, peri, hupa, para, huper, soon, pra, and anti. And so these are your most common prepositions that you're going to see most frequently. So it's important, obviously, learn all of them, but For me, I find it helpful to memorize the most frequent ones first in order to recognize them, because you're going to see them more often when you read, and so you'll start recognizing them sooner. But did you guys find this helpful last time? The Adventure of the Lion. It just cracked me up. I kind of enjoyed that.
Is that part two? Oh.
No, sorry. Yeah, all right. He was, you were fascinated with it, right? He's like, I want part two of The Adventure of the Lion. All right, so let's just quickly, I know this is well-traveled ground for us, but let's review briefly. So I'll just start up here in the front. Number one, read that for us and translate.
Cross, or Tom, Leonta.
Good, Leonta. So that is, translate.
In front of or before the lion.
Yeah, so it's actually... So notice pros
towards.
Is, yes, it's in number one, it's with the accusative. And so it's a little bit more of a toward. It's like a motion. He's in motion, walking toward the lion. The second one is pros to leonti. So that is with the dative. And notice how he is now standing still before or in front of the lion. Or para is alongside the lion. Number one, paratan leonta can also mean, because it's a motion, so with that accusative, it can mean like he's walking beside or even passing by the lion. And then two is to or toward the lion. So, Eric, number three.
Epitan leonta.
Good. Translation. That's a fair translation. It would be probably more like upon the lion. But the idea is, yeah, he's sneaking up. He's kind of stalking the lion, but he's coming up upon the lion. Okay, you got number four.
Periton leonta.
Translation?
Around the lion.
Good, around the lion. So he's running a circle around the lion. Number five, you want to take a stab at number five?
What's that rough breather over there?
It's actually not a rough breather. Here, let me zoom in a little bit, sorry. It's not, just a smooth accent. So it would be soon. And just
soon toe.
Yep, good. Soon toe. Soon toe leonti. Good. Soon toe leonti. Or notice these actually mean the same thing. Soon toe leonti or meta tu leontas. But what is the case of the top one, the first line? Soon toe leonti. Toe leonti is what case? Okay. Good. So dative. So soon with the dative means with the lion. And here the idea is they're walking together, right? It's kind of silly in the cartoon, but it makes the point. He's with the lion. But also the meta tu leontas, meta, remember, with the date, or I'm sorry, genitive, because that's a genitive, then it also can mean with.
Okay.
But if the meta is with the accusative, it means... After, metatauta. Yep.
What's the significance in this caption of the lion has the walking stick?
That's a good question. I have no idea.
What happened in the last caption?
Yeah, what was the last one? He was running a circle around it, and then he picks up the walking stick.
So he just picked it up.
That's what it was. Yeah, see? That makes total sense. Okay, where are we? James, number six. Good. Anna. Anna ton leonta. Good. So, Anna would be Remember?
Up.
Yeah, good. Up or above the lion. And so either he's like crawling up on top of the lion, or he's, you know, I don't know, he's waving his hand above the lion. I'm not sure what that means, but it means like above the lion or up to the lion. Really, yeah. But a little bit different is number 7, which, how would you read and translate 7?
Vertu leontas.
Good. But who? Good. Above. Above the lion. So Huppert is like, again, he's in the air, totally above the lion. So that probably is, 6 would better be, I guess, like
climbing up.
Yeah, climbing up on the lion. Yep. But then Huppert is above. He's now flying above. The lion like flipped him up. He's above the lion. Well, now, back to you, Grant, number 8.
Vertu leontas.
Good. Translation? Good. So there's, he's rather than just climbing up or above, he's now upon. He's sitting on the back of the lion, you know, upon the lion. Okay, number 9.
Vertu leontas.
Translation? I look at that and I think slide. No, no, but so think down. Good. So Anna is up, Kata is down. Now that's Kata with the genitive. With the accusative, it can mean according to or even against, depending on the context. But number 10. Good. Under the lion. So then pronunciation, you're real close, but it's hupa,
okay. Okay.
To leonti.
Okay.
Good. Under the lion. Excellent. Okay, back to you, Corey. Number 11.
Eis ton leonta.
Leonta. Good. Eis ton leonta. Translation?
Inside the lion.
Good. Or more like into. So it's a directional, like he's in the process of going in,
okay,
into the lion. But then number 12 is, that would be, 12 would be in the lion.
Actually in.
In or inside the lion. Yep. So now he's in the belly, and that would be in to leonti.
One more
of
a verb then?
No, not technically, because you would, it can be, sometimes you see that in Greek where it'll just give a prepositional phrase. And it's implying a verbal action. But most of the time you'll have a verb attached to that, which would be like going or, you know, like some, a verb of motion. But eis ton leonta is like the into or toward. It's a kind of a motion preposition.
So this one does not have the verb form?
Mm-mm. Okay. No, no, technically no. There is kind of a verbal idea. It's implying motion in the just the preposition eis. But it is technically just a preposition, an article, and a noun. Into the lion. And then in or inside the lion would be number 12, into leonti. And then number 13, James?
Ecto leontas.
Good. Ecto leontas. Good. Translation?
Out of the lion.
Good. Out of the lion. Excellent. So, ek again, think exit, going out. Being expelled from the lion pukes him up. And then number 14? Yeah, good. So from, away from, is the idea. He's now leaving. Which technically, again, there's not technically a verb there, but it's the idea of direction, from, away from the lion. Excellent. And notice that's apa with the genitive. Okay, so that's just kind of quick review. So a couple of just other comments that we weren't able to get to last time, and then just some exegetical significance in prepositions, just because it's fun. So a prepositional phrase, again, is typically a preposition with its noun. So like notice all of these are prepositional phrases. Upon the lion, down the lion, under the lion, but it's a phrase, so it includes a preposition And in this case, an article and a noun all together, that would be the prepositional phrase. But a prepositional phrase can function really as almost any part of a sentence. It can be an object, it can be a subject, or subject complement. Like, we are from the desert. Technically, from the desert is a prepositional phrase, but it would be a subject complement. Adverbs, in the dark days, we were without Greek books. In the dark days, we were without Greek. So the in the dark days part is functioning adverbially. It can be a subject, object, adjuncts. So like, you can't make a sandwich without bread. So notice again, the without bread is technically a prepositional phrase, but it's functioning like, in this case, an adjunct or an add-on to the object. So they can function almost as any part of speech is what I want you to see. More noun parts of speech, but or adverbs. But prepositional phrases are very frequent in the New Testament, and so you'll get used to them. But there's also a thing that I'm just going to introduce you to because I think it's helpful, but there's also a thing called prepositional prefixes, where it will take a word and then it will attach a prepositional prefix to the word. So I give you 7 examples here. So like anistemi is technically the preposition ana in front of the verb istemi or histemi. So histemi means I stand, but then when you put ana on top of that or in the front of it, you prefix the preposition ana to the verb to stand, then it means stand up, right? Or to raise, to cause someone to stand up. Or appoint, because it's used that way as well, is to cause someone to stand up and or to stand them up in a position is also used to, or also means to appoint somebody. Another example is apodidomi. So didomi, you just learned that one on your vocab list. That's whatever that was, number 4 down from the top. Didomi means give. Apodidomi means give back, to give back, or even repay. Sometimes it's used to refer to repay. So number 3, like epitithemi is the word tithemi, which means to put or to place. But epi is the preposition on or upon. So when you say epitithemi, now it's one word. It's just, they take the prefix, the preposition prefix at the beginning of the verb, and it means to put on. Epitithemi, to put on. It's synonym with a different word that means to clothe, right? So you can put on clothes or put on something. Number 4, kath istemi is technically kata and histemi jammed together. And it means to set down or establish. So to histemi means to stand. But to stand down or to sit down is the idea of I set something down, like if I have my water bottle and I set it down on the table, or to set down like a rule, a law, or a regulation can also be translated to establish something. Number 5, paradidomi. This is the word that is used of Jesus being betrayed by Judas and handed over to, be delivered unto death. So didomi means to give. Para is the idea of as over or across, beside. And so para didomi means to hand over or to deliver. You see how this works? So it's actually really helpful once you start studying. So like in your larger list of vocab, I don't know if not that you've glanced through all of it, but what's interesting is in the first couple 300 words, you're going to learn a lot of you use basic verbs like histemi, tithemi, didomi, and you're learning your prepositions. But later in the list, you're going to start seeing these words, these later on words, because they appear less frequently, like anistemi or apodidomi. But because you already know the root verb and you know the preposition, then you can kind of almost figure it out before you memorize the word. And so it can be helpful just to understand those prefixes. Now, one more comment on that. Prepositional prefixes are sometimes, again, prefixed right on the front of a verb. Sometimes these prefixes add no discernible change to the meaning of the word. So if you look it up in a lexicon, there's times where there's no discernible meaning difference in, you know, between the forms. But there's also a time where, like, the preverbs of a double compound do often contribute to the meaning of the word. In other words, here you actually see it changes the meaning from istemi, ana istemi is to raise up. It also will, you'll really learn this in your vocab list, but also a prepositional prefix can sometimes intensify the form of the verb. So it doesn't change the meaning, right? The verb means the same thing, but it's a more emphatic way of saying it. Does that make sense? So like you prefix a preposition on the front to intensify the meaning of the verb. And yeah, I'm trying to think of a good example.
Two words.
Yeah, that would be more like an adverb and an adjective. But trying to think, there's actually I want to say there's two or three of them in Philippians chapter 2, because when I was translating through Philippians 2, it stood out to me how many emphatic forms of the word are there. Where, and I'm trying to remember right off the top of my head, I can't remember which ones, but I'd encourage you, or we could even, here we go. Let me just get out of this. Let's go to Philippians 2 real quick. So, so Philippians 2, trying to remember where it pops up. But there's several intensive forms of the words where, and it can be a noun or a verb, but with a preposition attached, sometimes it comes across very, you know, just all the more intensely. So let me just see if I can find a quick example. So here's actually an example. Verse 6, hos en morphe theou huparkon. So huparkon is technically, that's a prefixed form on the, there, that's a preposition on the front of a word, but that actually does change the word a little bit. Because arkon means beginning, like archaeology, or in arche, ein holagos, you know, John chapter 1, or in the beginning was the word. So arkon means that, but then huparkon is actually hupa, attached to the front of it. So it's like under the beginning, or it's actually the word that means to exist, to be, or even to pre-exist. Like you were under or before the beginning. Does that make sense? It's actually kind of a cool word.
It's another existing word.
Yeah, it's another word. Oh yeah, there's several. You're right, that's a good catch. There's several words in Greek that mean to be or to exist, but they all have different nuances, right? Like ginomai is the idea of to become, come into existence, whereas ami is more to exist regardless of time. But this is actually the more of, almost has the idea of to pre-exist or to, you know, not always. Like in this context, it's pretty clearly saying that, that speaking of Jesus Christ, right? Because this is Philippians 2:5, right? This, let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus, who being or pre-existing in the form of God, did not something to be grasped, consider, did not consider it something to be grasped to be equal with God. And so that's kind of a cool one. I'm trying to think here. Nope, that's just an aorist. Oh yeah, here's a good one. Verse 9. Therefore God also, so you can see it in the English over here, therefore God also has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, So notice in verse 9, it says, dia kai hatheos, wherefore, or therefore, also, God, him, and then here's our verb. And it is huper upsomen, upsosen. And the idea is it's not just exalted or lift up, but it is huper, lifted up. So he lifted highly above is the idea. So it's not just he lifted him up, but it's an emphatic form of it. He exalted him high above every other name. And so like that's kind of a cool one. So you have the huper preposition attached right to the verb to make it more emphatic. This is more of it's an adjective, but notice there's another prefix right here. So it's, anyone want to take a stab at pronouncing that? I just highlighted it at verse 10. Yeah, it's the theta. Kata. Thonion. Yeah, that's a lot of sounds all jammed together. But, so it's translated, it's the idea of under the earth. But notice the kata prefix is to the idea of down, under the earth. So there's another example there. This is a good one. See, I thought there were several examples here. This is a good one, verse 11. First line. Grant, can you read that? The highlighted portion. Do I need to zoom in and make it a little bigger?
Kai asa glosa.
Good. Excellent. And every or all tongues, except that's actually in the tongue is in the singular, so you'd probably translate that every tongue. And then here is the word that is confess, but it's with the preposition ek in front of it. So it's ek homologeo. And this is, so it's the idea is you don't just confess, you cry out, you confess out, right? So it's a more emphatic form of the word. It still means basically the same thing, but it's just a little bit more emphatic. It's like they're crying out that Jesus is Lord. Ace or to the glory of the Father. The glory of God the Father. So I don't know if that answers your question, but like that's actually probably the best example that we've seen in this passage is that it's not just to confess, because homologeo is a word that just means to say the same thing as to confess, to agree, right? Which is, again, that's cool. Legeo, you already know that. Because logos would be the noun form. Legeo would be the verb form. So it's a word or to speak. But then homo, right? Just like homosexual, right? It means same. So to say the same thing as, homo legeo is to say the same thing as, or to confess. But ek homo legeo is you take the preposition and put it on the front, and it intensifies the idea. So you're still confessing, but it's like most English translations aren't going to draw that out. You're just going to see it in Greek and be like, okay, if you're teaching this passage, then you have to, you should probably draw attention to that. That it's not just homologeo, it's ek homologeo. So it's a stronger, like, cry out. It's a more emphatic way of confessing. So that's probably the better example of that. That's a good question, though. I'm fascinated by that. So there are, just be sensitive to that. There are several verbs that when a preposition is attached to it, it just intensifies the meaning. And that's kind of fun. Okay, so just that was the thing we couldn't get to last week. But then let's just look at a couple examples of exegetically significant, in this case, adverbs or prepositions. And then we'll move on to verbs. All right, but who just read last? Oh, you have a question, sorry.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Did we get the word archaic from the word archaic?
Yes. Yep, yep. It actually, I'm pretty sure it's a direct derivative. Isn't that cool? There's a lot of words in English that you actually, Greek words that you start recognizing because we do use them in English. Or a form of them. Like archaeology, same thing. It's the study of the beginning. Yep. The study of antiquity, or that which is archaic. Yep. That's good. Okay, so whose turn is it to read? I'm trying to remember who. Eric? Oh, okay. He just threw you into the bus. So can you read just the first line till the comma? I can underline it. Good. Phanerothe. So adverb, I just have the adverbs underlined, is the idea of when Christ, and then you haven't learned that word yet, have you? Phanereo, to appear or to shine forth.
Is it like spontaneous?
Wait. Spontaneous, you mean like?
Appear. Scientifically spontaneous,
you
should say.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think, I have to look at the usages because it's normally means to become visible.
That's what science would say, spontaneous combustion.
Okay. Yeah. I'd have to look at the usage to see if that's like true all the time. You know, if that's always a nuance that it carries with it. I'm not sure about that. But it does, it means normally to appear. And here, I think it's talking about the second coming, when Christ appears, but then next phrase, the next underlined phrase. Rough breather and an eta, hey.
Okay, hey. I can't remember what letter that is.
That's the Z, the zeta. So omega, zeta, omega, eta.
Zoe.
Exactly. Zoe. Basically think Zoe. Zoe. Upsilon. Yep, so it's the U, like the U sound. Humon. Good. Humon. So if we were to translate this, so you have Christ, when Christ appears, and then it's the life of us, technically, or our life. But notice it's in the nominative case, and it's actually modifying Christ. So that's why in English they'll normally say, when Christ, who is our life, appears. Which is interesting, you know, just in of itself, that Christ is equated with our life. But Christ, when Christ, who is our life, appears, tate, then. So notice when, hatan, is when, tate is then. So notice the adverbs. When he appears, then at that time, kai humes, you also, soon, auto. So do you remember soon auto? Do you remember our lion, adventures of the lion? What does soon with the dative mean? It's with. This is when the lion was walking with him. You remember that in the staff? He was holding the staff and they were walking together. But then you also, with him, soon auto, and then this is actually the future passive of the previous verb, will appear with him in doxe, in glory. So notice.
Yeah, what's the pronunciation of the word just before that last name, in glory?
So it's phane ro the sesta. It is a mouthful.
I was almost close.
So we're, yeah, I'm telling you. So we're going to learn this here starting tonight. If we'll see how far we make it. But so phane ro is actually the root. And then the theta eta sigma is the signifier of the future passive. And then the epsilon is a, they call it a connector vowel. And then the ste is the second person plural ending. Okay. So you all will be, will future be made to appear. And the idea is it's passive. It's a future passive idea. So it's we're receiving the action. Then you will be made to appear with him in glory. All right. So kind of like we were talking about this morning in the morning service, right? Our glorification happens at his second coming. And this is one of the most explicit statements of that in the New Testament. Well, there's a bunch of explicit, you know, several. We looked at a few this morning, but this is a good one. So we'll start learning how to parse verbs later, but we're getting close to verbs, right? We'll introduce them tonight, but that's a good question. So it's phane ro thesesta. That's a lot of parts of that word, okay? Yeah. Yeah, it's a mouthful. But
I got through the first three letters.
There you go. Hey, fun, right? You're like, ah, so close.
The part is like its own little word, so that's a phrase.
Yeah. Yeah, so you will be made to appear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But
exactly.
In Greek, don't they mash that all together sometimes?
Yeah, so that's one, technically that's one word.
Yeah.
But we need a phrase in English to say that.
Okay.
Yeah. Because the idea is to appear, but then it's in the future passive, so will be made to appear, but then it's you, second person plural. You will be made to appear. So it is basically a phrase in one word.
It's kind of like playful.
It's like what?
Playful, full of play.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. Yep. And we do the same thing, kind of, in English. Greek just does it more.
Unplayful.
Yeah, there you go. Not full of play. Unplayful. Exactly. It's the same thing. We're taking a core idea and putting a prefix or a suffix on it, and we're just playing with the meaning of that word. But the word, you know, the core idea remains the same. But in this case, it's second person plural, future passive. And so it's a mouthful, but that's why verbs are really cool. They're complicated. There's a lot to learn about verbs, but they are just packed with meaning. And so they're really in many ways, and it's the work for, you know, it's the workhorse of any language is their verbs, but Greek is no different. It the verbs are very important. But notice again, the way the prepositions work in particular is we will then, when he appears, then we will appear or be made to appear with him in glory. And the idea is that we will be with him as he is himself glorious, you know, or in glory, in the realm of glory, there we will be with him. And so it implies our glorification. And so, but notice the with him in glory are two prepositional phrases. Again, we can get lost in this and spend the rest of our night doing it, but, you know, Hebrews 2:10 is ton, archegon. So again, you know, the first word, cause you just asked about it. So arche is the prefix to that word. This is a noun cause you see the article in front of it, ton archegon. Have you learned the word, have you learned the verb ago? Yet, alpha, gamma, omega, ago. It means to lead or to go. And so archegon is actually the word ago with arche jammed together. And so it's a noun. So it means the one who goes before. Or a trailblazer is the way that you would say that. So the archegon tastes... Soterios, what's that mean? Soterios.
Soteriology.
Good. It's connected to soter. Soter is the verb to save. This is the noun form, so salvation. So the archegon, the trailblazer of our salvation, dia, there's our preposition that I'm after. Dia, I have it, you know, in red. pathematon teleosai was made perfect through suffering. Yep. But notice the dia, I think it's interesting that he was not made perfect by suffering. You know, I mean, it has a similar idea, but it actually uses the word that most often means through. So like back to our, you know, our chart, do you see here is dia, to go through. And so again, it's a rather picturesque way of referring to his suffering. He was made perfect. How? Through suffering. In other words, he had to go through the experience of difficulty in order to be perfected or completed. So that's, again, kind of a cool preposition. The preposition brings a bit of a nuance to that, that you're like, oh, that's really interesting. I'm trying to think how much time, because we're still doing all right on time, but... So let's do, because I've got like three more examples, but I'm trying to pick which one instead of all three. What sounds most interesting? 2 Corinthians 3:18, John 10:11, or 2 Corinthians 5:20 and 21?
Second one.
2 Corinthians 5? Okay. This actually is a really interesting one. Okay. So 2 Corinthians 5, 20 and 21 is, let's just kind of work through it real quick. So it's first line. Is huper, there's our preposition, and there's a special usage to that preposition I want to draw your attention to. But huper Christou un presbuamen hos tu theou para kaluntas. So the idea is, therefore, because this is a post-positive, therefore... the idea is, so huper, the reason I bring you here is you see what three times in this, you see the preposition huper, and in these contexts with the genitive, it has the idea of being in the place of or in the stead of. And so here it's God or Christ is in the stead of God, reconciling the world through him. In other words, God, the Father, is seeking to reconcile the world to himself, but he's using Christ in his place. Christ is in his stead. But then it goes on to describe...
What is...
Yeah. This word?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Keep trying. You're close. Good.
Okay. Remind Paraclete.
Good. Good. You're recognizing it. Good.
I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to remember what that means. Is that minister or?
Okay. So yes. So let's break that down real quick because it's really kind of a cool word. You already know it, and that's actually another example of kind of what we were talking about earlier. Is the verb, the core of that word is kaleo. Have you learned that word yet? Kaleo means to call or to invite. Para is a preposition. Remember, what does it mean? What were you going
to
say?
Is it something to do with air?
No, no. But para, it means alongside, right? To go beside or to pass by. So a paraclete is one who has been called alongside. Yep, or as a, it's sometimes translated minister or helper or something like that.
It is a term used in the Holy Spirit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, and this is the verb form, but it's in the participial form. So let's actually, let's kick out of this quick. Go ahead, what were you going to say?
Christ is called by God to minister alongside us. Is that?
So, let's just discard that. So let's go to it in here. So you can see it right alongside with the English. What was that? 2 Corinthians 5:21, was it? 20 and 21. There we go. So, huper Christu, therefore, and this is to be an ambassador. We are ambassadors in the place of Christ, or for Christ. There's the huper. For now, we are ambassadors for Christ, or in the place of Christ, as though, so here's your as though God, and it's we're pleading or calling alongside or inviting alongside through us. So notice again the English over here. When, now then, we are ambassadors for Christ, or in the place of Christ, as though God were pleading through us, we implore you on behalf of Christ to be reconciled to God. So notice the huper is to be in the place of Christ. That he is, we are ambassadors in the place of Christ, or we are carrying on the ministry that Christ himself began, which is to plead or call, invite. That's the verb form, because paraclete would be the noun form. Okay. But this is the verb form, to call alongside or invite. It's as though God were pleading through us. And then he says, so we implore you, or we beg or request, huper Christu, in the place of Christ, or on Christ's behalf, be reconciled, passive, be reconciled. It's a passive imperative. We'll talk about that later. But be reconciled to God. So the idea is that we are functioning as ambassadors in the place of Christ. And it's God is pleading through us as if Christ himself, right? We're pleading through us to be reconciled to God. So that's a pretty strong statement with that huper preposition. But then notice how it's used in the next verse, verse 21. Ton me gananta hamartian huper humon hamartian, epoiesin. For he made him, who knew no sin, to be sin, and then that's the idea of for us, or in our place. Right? The huper is a pretty, it only appears this way in the New Testament, I don't know, maybe half a dozen times. It's not that frequent, but it's a strong idea of being in the place of, or in the stead of. So notice Christ, who knew no sin, was made sin for us, or he took our place. And now that we became, you know, right with God, now we take his place as being an ambassador in his stead. Does that make sense?
So how do they go from the meaning of repair, which is above, to that?
Mm-hmm.
Is the case change? Is something changing in there? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So let me just pull up the lexicon here quick. So the best way to answer that is to go to a lexicon. So probably BDAG would be our best answer here. So this will just take you through the usage. So huper is a preposition with the genitive and accusative. Notice this is literally, SV is, look up the word ana. So in other words, it's similar to the word ana. And it says beginning, meaning the beginning of the article of ana. So it means it's a synonym with ana, to be above. But it says, in addition to this, huper, and then it just quotes these guys and where they have this information. The locative or the locational sense over above is not found in our literature, not in the LXX either, but in Josephus. No, I'm sorry, that's not Josephus. That's Joseph and Asenath, earlier source. So it's quoting a bunch of early sources, but does appear in non-literal senses. So then it's going to break out the main meaning of this word and how it's used in various contexts. So first, it's a marker indicating that an activity or event is in some entity's interests, for, in behalf of, for the sake of someone or something else. So he says this is normally with a genitive of person, or that is a personal genitive or human collective, after words that express a request or a prayer. And so this is just, these are the words that request, express a request or a prayer. Also, it can be after words and expressions that denote working, caring, concerning, etc. So he's going to go and he's going to just show you how it's used in a bunch of different contexts. But then what's helpful is you kind of survey this article, and not that it's infallible, but BDAG is very solid, is you start looking for, so like right here is our passage. See how it's listed? 2 Corinthians 5:20. So here he's describing how huperitinos can be for someone or someone be on someone's side. So this is a usage that also appears in these other passages. Mark, Luke, Romans, Acts 26, 1 Corinthians 4, 6. And so he's using this as a, he's just showing you where it can be used in that particular way. And it's all context.
The words that are around it.
Correct. So it's not just the word itself, but it's in the genitive case. Typically, as he puts it up here, with genitive of person or a human collective. And so this is where lexicons are invaluable. Like, because, you know, this is a ridiculous amount of research that you could spend 2, 3, 4 hours trying to track down every single usage and come to your own conclusions. But they do that and they kind of condense it into, you know, an article form for you. Is they've done all that work already and they try and show you where it's used in different ways. But then that was like, what, number one? But then if we go all the way down to like number, so that's A, B, C, there we go, two, is it'll give you another main body of usage, marker of moving, cause or reason. Number three, it can refer to a marker of general content, whether of discourse, mental activity, concerning or about, is sometimes translated that way. So like it's, and I encourage you, if you have BDAG, great. If not, use the lexicon you have. BDAG is just kind of the mother of all lexicons. But read the articles on prepositions in particular. Because like I was saying, prepositions are kind of elastic. And it really depends on what case they're in, as well as what words they're around. So like going back to what we said earlier. Yeah, right there, that my second bullet point. They can be somewhat elastic. They can have multiple meanings depending on the context, case, and the word it's modifying, which is often, that's where BDAG is going to really help you out, is where it'll show you where certain words it's modifying, like in that case, personal noun in the genitive, it can mean in the place of or for the sake of.
So at some point it became slang for something and got ripped out of its meaning.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes and no, because that does happen in Koine Greek, because it's like it's evolving.
Yeah, it's
and then
evolving.
Yep, and then we're kind of getting a snapshot of it. But I think prepositions by their very nature are like that in most languages. Mm-hmm. So is we can, because we can imply a number of different meanings with a single preposition. And it's really context that helps you catch the nuance. Which is, it's hard to learn. This is one of the frustrating things about Greek, but also fun once you kind of, you know, get used to it. But the frustrating thing is you wish there was just a one-for-one, you know, word and definition, and it was that way every single time. But no language is really like that, right? I mean, we'll use the same, you know, I use the example of the verb to run, right? Like I ran to the store, I ran a mile, the refrigerator is running, my nose is running, right? Like that's, I hit a home run, right? Those are all the same word, but it's used a half a dozen different ways, depending on the context and what words are surrounding it. And so and Greek's the same way. So sometimes we learn these words in kind of a one-for-one, you know, simple definition, because it's kind of like giving you a crutch to, you know, learn how to walk a little bit. But then once you kind of learn how to walk, you throw the crutch away and you start developing more nuanced understanding of the language.
Yeah, I've noticed that. When I was young, I had a lot of relatives who would always come over from Norway, and they knew English better than I knew English. But when it comes to conversation, like just throw out the word buck. I mean, it can signify what a horse does to a rider, a single dollar.
Dollar?
A male deer.
A male deer with antlers?
And so they're like, what are you talking about?
That's good. It's a good point.
By using the language, you incorporate all those nuances.
Right.
But it's only through repetition.
Yep. And that's really getting to the point where you start mastering the language, yeah, as you start seeing the nuances and picking up. And that's really a lifetime. You know, like, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm at that mastery level. I just have BDAG, you know, and I have English translations. But that's one of the things that helps me is, like, if I'm translating, because I did the same thing. When I was first translating 2 Corinthians 5, I'm like, and above Christ. And then I look at all the English translations and not a single one of them say that. And I'm like, well, what am I missing? Why are they not translating it above? And then you dig into BDAG and it explains it for you. And they're like, well, because it's with a genitive noun, personal, you know, noun. And in those contexts, it can mean in the place of or for the sake of instead. And you're like, oh, I didn't know that. Now I do. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I'm trying to think, like, even in a sense, being raised above Christ in the sense of that we are the one that comes into contact with people and beg and plead with them versus, like, Christ is doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we are raised, and I mean, like, if you look earlier in 2 Corinthians, where he's talking about how we have this treasure of knowing God and earthen vessels, like, we're raised above where we should be in our sinful, vile state to apply a place that Christ has given us as his ambassadors. Like, even with, I don't know.
Christ, well, and I...
theology, no.
Yeah, so maybe I'm misunderstanding.
No, that's... I don't know. You just gave me a thought, and I'm just totally going to speculate here for a second. And this is where I need to spend more time in lexicons. And huper is one of the most fascinating prepositions that if you get into it, there's whole books and articles written on this because it is a unique case. So I'm glad you picked that one. Okay. But I think it's TDNT is the other lexicon that really does a lot of historic survey stuff, which is helpful, not always pertinent to New Testament because he's kind of lost in the weeds of like what this word used to mean, you know, hundreds of years before the New Testament was written. And so it doesn't always pertain to the New Testament, but it is interesting in showing you the evolution of words. So don't quote me on this. I'd have to double check his lexicon. But kind of like you were saying earlier, if there's a usage that huper has that then takes on a new nuance, is the thought that I had as you were talking was, you know, huper means above most fundamentally, right? If you want to call it that. But to be in the place of, it's like almost, you know, Christ was in our place, taking our sin upon himself. But it's almost like the picture of he's above us. Like he almost casts his body over us, you know, in protecting us. And then he takes our place. Mm-hmm. He takes the hit in our place.
On behalf of,
exactly. In other words, like a mother hen, you know, over the chicks, you know, now she's protecting. And I wonder if there aren't usages like that, that over time you use it in a slightly poetic or an abnormal way, but then it just kind of gets codified in the language. And that's now the way you express that idea.
The example of running is a good example of that because there is a sense of running in all of those meanings.
You're right.
The machine that's actually moving.
The machine is running. There's a moving part. Yep.
There's a sense of the feel of the words in it.
Exactly. Exactly. But each context is a little different, slightly different. But they're all connected, you know, like you can think about it for a little bit, and you're like, okay, yeah, those are all...
It has the feel of the word.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
Yes.
So above is something higher, so maybe that's true.
So I'd have to... That's an interesting... I'd have to do a little TDNT work on that just to see if there's if he traces that, and like, where does that usage start? You know, because that's the cool thing about like his lexicon is he's looking over the hundreds of years of that, and he's got a lot of cool scholarship. I mean, warning on him, he was a Nazi. Okay, so he was in the Nazi German party. Okay, so literally, okay. I'm just saying. So, he looks great on a bookshelf because there's like 20 something volumes of his work or whatever. I mean, it's like huge work. I don't know if it's that many, but it's a lot of volumes. And he's kind of, he does more work in the, they call it diachronic. In other words, diachronic is a Greek word through time. So it's called diachronic study of words, is how does this word evolve through time? And he's very exhaustive in looking at like classical Greek, Septuagint Greek, New Testament Greek, and then later Greek. And so he shows you how these words evolve over time, which are kind of fun, right? But it's not all, but it sometimes can lead you astray because you're trying to figure out what does it mean in the New Testament, and he's telling you about something that's like, you know, hundreds of years removed from that. And it doesn't always have a one-for-one ratio, right? And so, like, again, we see it in English, like the old King James, read, you know, to, you know, the meat offering is a great example of that. And you're like, meat offering, it actually has nothing to do with meat. It's actually grain. It's the grain offering. But in old English, 400 years ago, they used the word meat to refer to any sustenance. And so... Yeah, exactly. And so you're like, man, they got that so wrong. And it's like, well, no, they didn't get it wrong. We have changed the use of the word. 400 years later, we use the word differently now. And so that's where it's same things happening in Greek. And Koine is, while Greek is right, it's leaving the classical era. It's getting dumbed down for the sake of the populace, right? And it's like a snapshot of that. There's about a 300 or 400 year window where Koine Greek kind of becomes a thing. But that's different than modern Greek. Yeah. You know, like you said, you're in Duolingo. Is it you, Walter? Mm-hmm. But that's modern Greek. And so, like, you're going to see some overlap, but there's a lot of stuff happening in modern Greek didn't happen in Koine. And in Koine Greek, you know, like, they could technically, it's kind of like if I were to go to modern Greece and, you know, I've been to modern Greece, and I can read most of their signage because I know Koine Greek. But if I was to speak Koine Greek, it would... You know, they would laugh at me. It would be like an Elizabethan, yeah, like a King James, you know, stepping into the modern day.
That'd be cool.
I'm sure a lot of people actually do that.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, but language is so fascinating, though. It just evolves over time, and it's really interesting.
And that's why, like, for example, the medicine uses Latin because it's a dead language. It doesn't do that.
It's not true.
Good point.
So,
yeah,
so
it's
static. I can talk to a doctor in Japan, and if we're using the medical terminology, we're on the same page because the meaning doesn't evolve.
That's good. That's a good point. Which, yeah, and that's the same thing. Yeah, with medicine or science, you know, they're going to use Latin,
because
a lot of Latin.
It's a static language.
It's not... actively spoken and therefore evolving.
Are
that's good.
Hebrew like that as well, out of curiosity? Are they kind of dead language, like what the Bible is written in?
Well, not technically, because there's still modern Greek, you know, and so like it's really like a picture, if I can put it that way, of an event centuries ago, right? So like we study Koine Greek, but Koine really had its heyday for about 400 or 500 years, something like that. And then it just continues to evolve.
And it was the language in the process of evolving.
Right.
When it was in use.
Right. Because classical Greek is much more complicated than Koine Greek. Koine just means common. It's common Greek, right, of the commoner, the non-native Greek speaker that was learning Greek, and they had to dumb it down for them. Pigeon Greek. Exactly. That's kind of what it is.
To technically be a dead language is no populace uses.
Correct, yeah. So no.
In a new form. Or
right. So Hebrew is no longer a dead language. It once was considered a dead language.
But it's being spoken now.
But it's been resurrected. Yeah. And it's the only language that we know of in history that was a dead language and then is resurrected to a modern country that uses it. Because the official language of Israel is Hebrew.
Yeah. They brought it back.
they brought it back. And it was a lot of work to bring it back. I forget the guy's name. It'll come to me. But there's a guy in the late 1800s who worked hard to resurrect it and then teach it in, you know, as Jews were coming to the land, they started, they established schools to teach the young people Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And so like when I went to Israel, my taxi driver was a native and he's like 50 years old and he was a native Hebrew speaker and that's all he ever knew. He couldn't speak English. But that, like, that's amazing. You know, historically, you know, on the stage of history, that is unique. Hebrew's the only language that we're aware of that's ever done that.
I mean, they're doing a similar thing with a lot of the Native American languages here, where they're trying to get the younger generation to use it. But technically,
to keep it alive,
yeah. But technically, yeah. You know, there's been the old generation that has continued to use the language. It was just kind of out of fashion, but it was still being used by the older generation. But now they're trying to infuse it into the new generation.
That's good.
But Hebrew literally stopped for how long? Maybe I'm wrong, but didn't it kind of morph into Yiddish kind of for a while? And that was the kind of language of the populace.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's a good example. Almost kind of a dumbed down version of Hebrew that kind of still existed, but the biblical Hebrew had to be resurrected. And he actually used, if I remember right, the guy who resurrected it used the Old Testament primarily as his means of resurrecting it.
Huh.
Yeah. It's yes, sir.
Grant's gonna like this because it rhymes with Yoda, but the man who resurrected it was Eliezer ben Yehuda.
Yehuda, thank you. Ben Yehuda.
Sounds like Yoda.
There we go. What was his first name?
Eliezer?
All these kids in there.
Eliezer, yeah. Eliezer, that's it. Eliezer ben Yehuda. That's what it is. Yep.
So
thanks for looking that up.
Has an introduction that is classical Greek. So they were still speaking classical Greek during the time that they were speaking Koine Greek?
So classical Greek was basically your native Greek speakers. But then they go conquer the world, right, under Alexander the Great. So all the people that were conquered and now forced to learn Greek, they evolve the language quite a bit because they're, you know, trying to understand it, simplify it. And so it kind of like turned into almost two tiers of language, which, you know, you kind of have your dumbed down version for the populace and then your more elites, your native Greek speakers. But then over time, then it just like the Koine kind of takes over because it's easier to learn, right? So like if you're now a young person, even in Greece, right? Like, I mean, why work harder to learn classical Greek? Like it's, you know, and no one's talking that way anymore. And so it's kind of like, it just evolves to like classical Greek. When we say classical Greek, it's the Greek of the Greek classics. So like in their written forms of all the old, you know, time Greek writers.
Is that what Luke was using? Because he uses a different Greek at the beginning.
Yes. So Luke is a good example in the New Testament. It's not full blown, you know, but it would be more akin to classical Greek than Koine, which is why it's the hardest Greek in the New Testament, is because he's well educated, is the point. And he's been educated by reading probably the Greek classics. And so his Greek is better than like a Matthew or a John or somebody who is not a native Greek speaker. And so they're more Koine Greek. And so Luke is still classified.
He changes, though, when he gets done with his introduction. He changes into a simpler Greek at some point, right? I read in a commentary with several of them that he uses a different sort of Greek in his introduction.
Okay.
And then he switches when he gets into the main body of his gospel.
That could be.
Simplified Greek.
Okay. Yeah, that could be. That could be.
Because he's
I'd have to look that up.
Legal.
To Theophilus.
Yeah, so he's addressing it in a very systematic way.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he gets into the telling of it, he simplifies.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That is interesting.
I guess that makes sense. He is a doctor.
Yeah. Well, exactly. It's actually evidence of he was very educated.
Yeah.
Yeah. But by, again, in the classics. Mm-hmm. And so like he was capable of that level of Greek. When most of the New Testament writers were not capable of that level of Greek.
Possibly Paul, right? Because of his education.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Because Paul has very, you know, polished Greek, but it's different.
Not quite religious.
Yeah, it's a little bit different in structure. Like, he's still very intense, basically because he has really long sentences, like a lot of relative clauses, a lot of dependent clauses. So, like, he's complex Greek, but he still is only, you know, using the main four cases. You know, it's not like the eight-case Greek of classical Greek.
Now, isn't that the argument for Hebrews? Because Hebrews goes into more of a classical style in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why a lot of people, I will might say it, me included, think that Luke wrote all sermons.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I...
It has a similar structure, but it has a more highfalutin.
Correct. Yeah, the Greek is more close. It's closer to like a Luke or Acts. But I and this is not original with me, but there's a church historian that says that Paul wrote it or in Hebrew or spoke it, but it was originally Hebrew and that it was Luke that translated it into Greek, which to me makes sense of both worlds. Cause most people look at Luke and they're like, how could he know? You know, like he's a Gentile, you know, like that's, and so most think, okay, it's definitely Pauline thought, but not Pauline Greek. But it was probably both. Yeah, it was Luke's hand and Paul's thought.
After studying the book of Luke, I definitely thought that.
Yeah. And to me, that makes the most sense of all the evidence. Yes. Is that it's Paul's thought,
Luke's hand.
But Luke's hand in either writing down a sermon of Paul or translating a Hebrew document into Greek for a broader audience. Yeah.
And if that's the case, then a Gentile wrote most of the New Testament.
Yeah, you mean word for word. Yeah, because when you combine Luke, Acts, and Hebrews...
Because he's the only Gentile in the Bible.
Yep, he's the only Gentile author. Yeah. I mean, we can debate about Job, but...
If he got Hebrews.
Right. But even just by standalone Luke and Acts, that's a pretty good chunk of the New Testament. Like, word for word, those are long books.
Hebrews is the only thing that would set him over.
Yes. Over 50% mark, you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If that would be the only thing that would set him over Paul.
Is in length.
The one that actually wrote Hebrews.
Oh, I see. Yeah. As in authored it, not just translated it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he would have written down his sermon.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
So in a way, he did author it because he was translating it. So there
sure.
They are his words.
Yes.
With somebody's ideas.
Correct. Yeah. Yep. Which is kind of similar to Mark.
Mark.
Right? Okay. So it's Peter's thought and words, but Mark's the penman.
Okay.
So both are involved in the process. But actually, that's probably true of multiple epistles, right? So like Paul, when it says Silvanus, mm-hmm. is his, you know, penman.
Right.
Again, thought is Paul, but the pen is Silvanus. So it's a team effort of a sort.
So then it gets
complicated. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. That's a good point. That is cool. Isn't this fun? Get lost in all the cool details. This is fun. I'm having fun. So
in 2 Corinthians 5, is it in the genitive or accusative?
Which word? So
if you look on our list at 109, it actually says that if it's in the genitive, it's in behalf of or about, and the accusative is above or more than.
Yeah, that's yes. That's that's on
our
master list, master vocab list. Okay, and you're right because look. There we go. Do I have it up on the screen? So huper Christou. So huper is in the same form all the time. It's the word it's attached to.
Right.
So, and you're right. It is in the genitive because Christou is genitive.
Okay.
And then it's the same down here with, where's the next one? Yep. Huper Christou again in the end of verse 20. And then same thing in verse 21. Huper humon or hamon. Hamon is just your personal pronoun. But it's first person, plural, genitive plural. So, yes. So that's a big part. And again, going back to BDAG, he makes that point in the very beginning, right? So with genitive of person or human collective, that's where it can be translated on behalf of or for the sake of. Good. No, I'm glad that's actually, what number is it?
109.
Okay, so that's on the list. We haven't got that far yet. Yeah, in your memory work. Yep, good. So huper, genitive, behalf of, accusative, above or more. Which is, again, I think when we go back to our little Leonta, you know, paradigm, it was, I'm suspect, where's the above one? Well, no, see, that's interesting because that's in the genitive. Right here.
So that's a mistake?
Yeah, or an exception.
On behalf of the lion.
Yeah, right. Yeah, in the place of the lion.
I mean,
the story here. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
That's biblical there.
Yeah. Amen. Good point. No, that's good. That's a good catch, Grant. Is like, I think, generally speaking, that must be the main thing. I'd have to do an exhaustive search on huper and the uses, but there's probably some exceptions to that. But I bet generally speaking, that's the case. With the genitive, it means on behalf of or for the sake of someone else. But with the accusative, it's above. And like you said, it has to be also with a genitive of person. Whereas accusative of thing, right? If it's not a person but a thing, then it would be more of a above, right? Because it's referring to a thing that is, you know, like above the whatever. You know, we're above the basement, you know?
So maybe they're treating lion like a thing?
That
would explain why it got eaten.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, a thing. In other words, not a person. Yeah, so an animal.
Yeah.
That would make sense. Well, I feel smarter. After discussing huper, well done, people.
Or more confused.
Yeah, right, or more confused. I don't know. Should we take a poll? I don't want to know. Just kidding. Okay, so we only have, what do we got? A little over 20 minutes, not quite 30. So let me maybe do just should we do a quick introduction to verbs?
Sure.
We won't get very far, but let me at least start introducing you to the idea of verbs. So we've anticipated it a lot. But verbs are the most important part of any language. Greek is no different. They're the most often, they're the most complex part of any language. And that is also true in Greek. So just start wrapping your mind around this. Every verb has five parts. So when you parse a verb, you are trying to identify the individual parts of the verb. And those five parts are tense, voice, mood, person, and number. Tense, voice, mood, person, and number. So I'll explain those as we go. But a tense is, there are six tenses in Greek, and that is the present tense, future tense, aorist tense, imperfect, perfect, and pluperfect. But pluperfect is very rare. We're, in fact, not going to spend a lot of time with that because I think I have I don't have it on a later slide. I thought I did. Of how many verbs appear in the pluperfect form, there's not very many in the entire New Testament. So it's very rare, not very common. So, it's not – I'll show you how to form it, but it's not going to be one that you encounter very often. So – your main one is going to be your present tense and aorist tense. Those are the most frequent, is present and aorist. And we'll talk about the differences between them. Some of those you understand intuitively because of English, but they function a little bit differently in Greek than in English. It's not just a pure time reference like past, present, or future, but it is... It implies more than just time, like the type of action. But there are six tenses, present, future, aorist, imperfect, perfect, and pluperfect. There are three voices, active, passive, or middle. Now, this is one of the cool things about Greek, and I talk about it all the time, or regularly, frequently I've talked about it, is that in English we just have active or passive voice, but in Greek you have a third option, and that is the middle voice. And that is, in English, we express a middle voice with a reflexive, right? So, I ate food is active, subject actively doing something upon an object. I ate food. But I was eaten. I wasn't eaten, okay? But, I mean, that would be in the passive, okay? I subject receiving the action. I was eaten. But in the middle voice, we would say in English, I fed myself. All right, so I am the one doing the action as well as the one receiving the action at this very same time. That's the middle voice. And so it's kind of cool, but that is built into the verbal forms of the Greek New Testament. Now, we'll talk about it most of the time, not always, because like an aorist is distinguished in a mainly aorist. But most of the time, your passive and your middle is the same form. It's the same form in Greek. It's either middle or passive, and it depends upon the context, and you have to determine that. But sometimes it's a distinct form. Like in the aorist tense, it's a distinct form. It has a middle form and a passive form that are different from each other. But most of the time, middle passive is the same form. And this is, I think I got this from Wallace and his count. So there, it's a little bit subjective. But the most common voice in the New Testament is active voice. 20,697 times, you know, the verbs in the New Testament appear in the active voice. Passive and middle are almost evenly split. Passive is 3,933 times, and the middle voice appears 3,500 times. But again, that's a little subjective because it kind of depends on context, whether it's passive or middle. And most of the time, when you're translating, they teach you to just default to passive because it's more frequently passive than middle. But you can make a really strong case in several contexts that it's better translated as a middle voice than a passive voice. All right? But that's context that determines that. In addition to tense and voice, you also have mood. And there's four different moods to the Greek verbs. You have the indicative mood, subjunctive mood, optative mood, and the imperative mood. Now, has anyone ever heard of this before? Are you familiar with the difference between indicative, subjunctive, optative, imperative? Some of those you already know. This is how we're going to proceed anyway. I'm skipping ahead real quick. Indicative verbs are the most common in the New Testament. 15,000 verbs. You know, out of all the verbs in the New Testament, 15,000, the vast majority are indicative verbs. So that's where we're starting, is the indicative verb chart. We'll start that next week. But the indicative verb is the most frequent form. And the indicative basically is the mood of reality, is how it's often described. Is what that means is that it is telling you facts, just stating a truism. Subjunctive is the mood of potentiality. In fact, it's even more, because technically subjunctive and optative are very similar. Optative is pretty rare in the New Testament, like you see on the screen. Only 68 verbs in the New Testament are actually in the optative mood. But subjunctive is actually, I guess, better stated as a probability, and optative as a possibility. It's like it's a weaker form, if you will, of the subjunctive. But they're very similar, and the optative is pretty rarely used. And so we're not going to spend much time with the optative mood. Really, we're going to primarily look at indicative and then subjunctive, because 1,858 verbs in the New Testament are subjunctive. And those are pretty important. You're going to see them in a lot of contexts, and they're very important to understanding a verse and interpreting a verse. But then not far behind subjunctive mood is the imperative mood. And the imperative, same in English, what's an imperative? Yeah, and it's a command. So it's commanding somebody to do something. And so imperatives are not that hard because they're only in the second person. So there's fewer forms of the imperative because that's by definition when I'm commanding you to do something, it's in the second person. You're addressing someone. And so there's fewer forms for that. We'll talk about it. But we won't really spend much time on the optative because it rarely appears. But then we're going to save for last. We're going to talk about infinitives and participles, which do not have mood. It's different. They're a different form of the verb. Infinitives are verbal nouns. Participles are verbal adjectives. But they are frequent in the New Testament. Infinitives show up 2,300 times, and participles about 1,800 times. And so there are a lot of infinitives and participles, and they're super cool. But you can do a lot of things with infinitives and participles. And so that's its own, beast to tame when we get to infinitives and participles. But again, back to just the basic components of a verb. There's tense, voice, mood, person, number. So tense, there are six tenses: present, future, aorist, imperfect, perfect, and pluperfect. Three voices, active, passive, or middle. Four moods, indicative, subjunctive, optative, which is very rare, only 68 times in the New Testament, and then imperative. So indicative, subjunctive, optative, imperative are your four moods. But then there's also three persons. Persons are, you're familiar with it, we do the same thing in English, first, second, third person. First person is I or we. Second person is you or y'all, right? That's you plural. Or third person is he, them. You're talking about a third party, right? So first person, I, we. Second person, you or you all. Third person, he, them. Or she, them. But then there's also... there's two numbers, right? Singular or plural. Singular or plural. One or more than one, right? So that's just like it is in English. So when you parse a verb, and we're going to learn the different forms, and we're going to try to practice parsing verbs, we'll practice here and there. But parsing verbs means that you identify all five parts of the verb, and then it often will include the root. So like you would say... this is a present active indicative first person singular of Luo, right? So you actually name the root as well. So when you're parsing, you're actually looking for six different things. The five parts of the verb and then the root of the verb is typically what you're looking for when you parse verbs. So there's a lot of stuff. I'm glad we're just introducing verbs tonight, but I'm glad we talked earlier about that... which passage was it? When we were talking about, the future passive second person plural of phino. So do you remember that? So this word right here is basically a phrase, as we were saying earlier. It's a phrase in one word. And so because you have your root, so you would cut it right there. And then he would cut that. That's the future passive. Then you have your thematic vowel or your connecting vowel. And then you have your ending. The ste is second person plural ending. So there's a lot of parts to that word. And that's a good example of what we were talking about earlier. Is if you were to parse that, then you would say that is a future passive indicative. Second person plural from phanereo. Phanereo is how you say that. Appear, to appear. And so that's a lot of information, right? You're like, whoa. That's why verbs are kind of overwhelming at first, is you're like, oh my goodness, there's so much to know about verbs. And we're starting with the indicative chart because, like I said, first, after being really intimidated, then let me try and comfort you a little bit, that while it is possible to memorize hundreds of Greek verb forms through brute strength, I would not recommend it. Okay. It's more efficient to learn how verbs are built from the root up, then be able to deconstruct the verb into its most basic parts. So that's where we're going to start, not tonight, but next week. We're going to start by trying to tackle the indicative verb chart. And we're going to, again, start with the indicative because it is the most frequent form of the verb. And then we'll go to subjunctive, then imperative. We're really going to kind of skip over optative. We're not going to spend a lot of time with that, other than just be aware that that's a thing. But you won't encounter it that often. But then you'll see, then we'll go to infinitives and participles. And this is going to take, what are we? I think today is week 7, I think. We've been meeting for 7 weeks. It's going to take us probably the next 7 or 8 to just tackle verbs. And then we'll start, once we kind of have our minds somewhat wrapped around how verbs work, and you're up to your, you know, almost 300 words of memorizing vocab, then we can start really jumping into the Gospel of John, right? And we're just going to start reading it, you know, start at John 1:1 and work our way through it. And it's a lot of fun. And, you know, that's where translation starts getting a lot of fun. But what we're going to do is we're going to start with the indicative verb chart because it's the biggest, it's the hardest, but it's also the most fundamental. Because once you understand that, then you just make a couple tweaks and you do subjunctives, imperatives, infinitives, participles. You know, you'll start recognizing the other forms if you know kind of the base forms of the indicative chart. And so we'll get into that starting next week, but you'll soon discover that verbs are basically, you build them. So I'm not going to walk through all of this tonight because we don't have time. I've only got a couple minutes left. But you have, you know, basically 4 major parts. When you look at a verb, you're trying to identify the root. What is the root word? And then, and you can only identify that. I mean, you can look it up in a lexicon. But you are going to try to identify that by memorizing your vocab, right? Is you should, by memorizing vocab, you will be able to identify, oh, I know what that word is, right? And you can find the root of the word. Well, then the next thing that you do is you look and you see, does it have a prefix? Or also known as an augment. Is there a prefix or augment to that root? Then you look to the connector. It comes after the root and it helps indicate what the tense and voice is. And then you'll look at the suffix, which will give you person number. And you know, we'll talk about it, but so you're looking at every verb, you're kind of looking at those 4 major parts in order to discern the 5 major parts of the verb. Is you're looking at the root, seeing if there's a prefix, because if there is a prefix, then it's going to be imperfect or aorist, or if there's reduplication, it'll be a perfect or pluperfect. We'll talk about that next time. But then you look at the connector and the suffix. And so there's kind of these major components that you're looking for, but not every verb is going to have a prefix, right? Because in the present and future tense, there is no prefix. In the subjunctive mood, there are no prefixes. And so you look at that and you're like, okay, I don't have to worry about the prefix. And, you know, there's the root. And then I'm going to try and find the connector and the suffix. And, you know, I'll walk you through this starting next week. But once you understand the major components and what you're looking for, then it becomes manageable. You know, I think by now, here we are week 7, is it? And Is it becoming a little more intuitive, like the case endings, right? As we were reading along and you're like, oh, toe, oh, that's dative. You know, to, oh, that's genitive. Tom, oh, that's accusative, right? I mean, like those are just because you put a little time trying to memorize that, but then just by using it, because now we're doing a little bit of translating every week, then you're like, oh, I'm starting to recognize that. It'll be the same thing with verbs. There's just more to memorize. There's more possible forms. There's more pieces and parts to verbs. So we'll come back and look at that starting next week. But thoughts, questions, comments? I should probably stop there. All right. So don't be too intimidated. So this system I learned, I actually learned by, he was a Greek scholar. He was an expert. Dr. Dean and Ken Dean. You remember him? Well, you've heard of him. You never met him. No, he died several years ago. I was in high school, and I took high school Greek from him, and he taught me some of these shortcuts, like the sin, you know, trick, S-I-N, to try and help memorize case endings. And, you know, this, the way he broke down verbs really helped me to where I was able to walk into a college course and I tested out a first year Greek because I had learned enough from Dr. Dean that I could get by. I could skip first year and jump straight into second year Greek. And it's kind of helpful, you know, it's again, it sounds intimidating, but it's not that hard. Just take it a piece at a time and we'll figure it out. So next time we'll come back and we'll start with kind of defining the tenses. All right. So we won't worry about that tonight. We don't have time tonight, but the six tenses, present, future, aorist, imperfect, perfect, pluperfect. We'll start looking at, because one of the things that I'm at least going to introduce you into is there's a traditional way of viewing them, which you're going to come across in a lot of commentaries and most, you know, works that are over 20 years old. But then there's kind of a more modern view of how they're used, particularly in discourse dynamics, which is more what they're teaching today in seminaries. And because the argument is our understanding of Greek has evolved to the point where we are seeing more of how these tenses were used than we have traditionally believed. And some of what traditionally has been taught is true, but only true part of the time. Like there's so many exceptions to the rule that we're like, we really need to invent a new rule, you know, because it's wrong or it's wrong, you know, too many times. There's too many exceptions. And so I'll get into some of that. It's really more second year stuff, but because you're all brilliant, then I'll introduce you to some of the second year stuff in first year, because it actually helps you just to start, you know, wrapping your mind around tenses and how they work and that sort of thing. So I'd actually be interested if Zoe's with us next week, what she's being taught in her high school class and how they're teaching her to use the, you know, and translate tenses, because the traditional way is to tie it strictly to time, or pretty much strictly to time. Whereas the modern way is to see it a little bit more dynamically and how it's functioning in a discourse. And so there's some interesting insights to be gained from that. So we'll introduce that idea a little bit next time and then just start tackling the indicative chart. All right? You all ready? All ready for that? Well done. I love it. Your game. All right. Well, well, you don't have to show up, I guess, but you know. But if you do show up, this is what we're talking about. Okay. All right. Well.
Nice of you to make us think we had a choice.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. Anything to help you feel better. All right. Well, if there's no more questions, let's close in prayer, shall we? All right, Corey, you want to close us in prayer?
Lord, we come to you tonight. We thank you for the word that you've given us. We thank you that we have a pastor here that's willing to devote his time to teach us how to better understand this word by better understanding the original language. We ask that you would go with each of us today. Help us to remember to carry your light into the world as we start our week anew tomorrow. Be with us, keep us in safety, and bring us back next week. We ask this in all prayers in the name of Christ Jesus. Amen.
Amen.